Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. President Barack Obama said Wednesday the United States and Cuba have agreed to reestablish diplomatic relations and plan to reopen embassies in Washington and Havana later this month. It's the latest move to end years of hostility between the two countries.
More than 54 years ago, at the height of the Cold War, the United States closed its embassy in Havana. Today, I can announce that the United States has agreed to formally reestablish diplomatic relations with the Republic of Cuba and reopen embassies in our respective countries.
President Obama made the comments early this hour in the White House Rose Garden. He also said the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will travel to Havana this summer to raise the flag over the first American embassy in over five decades. A letter sent by Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras to Eurozone ministers indicates Greece is prepared to accept most of the European Commission's terms for new bailout money. The letter was shared with news outlets on Wednesday, hours before European finance ministers were scheduled to hold a teleconference discussing Greece's latest plea for a deal. Officials, according to the Associated Press, officials confirmed that second Ebola case in Liberia. It comes as health workers protest a lack of hazard pay. We have more details on that story later in the hour. A border clash between Pakistan and Afghanistan overnight has left one Afghan security personnel dead and two Pakistani soldiers wounded, according to officials in both countries confirming Wednesday. A Pakistani military spokesman told VOA that its soldiers were engaged in construction activity on the Angar-Adab border area when they came under attack from the Afghan side. VOA News. A new report from the United Nations Refugee Agency shows that a record 137,000 migrants have made the journey across the Mediterranean Sea so far this year. That's an 83% increase as compared to the same period last year. The UN High Commission on Refugees released a report Wednesday saying Europe is living through a maritime refugee crisis of historic proportions as those migrants make the risky journey to seek better living and economic conditions in Europe. The head of the UN's nuclear agency will meet with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani in Tehran on Thursday. The meeting comes as negotiators from Iran and a group of six world powers continue working toward a comprehensive agreement ensuring the country's nuclear program is peaceful. Yukiya Amano's visit, reported Wednesday by diplomats and Iranian media, is expected to focus on access for inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency. They will monitor nuclear activity in Iran and would be the ones verifying compliance under any new deal. Islamic militants attacked Egyptian army and police positions in the northern Sinai Wednesday, causing numerous casualties. Egyptian media report that the Islamic State group has claimed responsibility. Edward Uranian reports.
Amateur video showed an explosion followed by a gigantic fireball after militants attacked one of a number of army checkpoints near the North Sinai town of Sheikh Zayed. Egyptian media report that dozens of soldiers were killed in a series of attacks on military positions in the northern Sinai. A military spokesman indicated that 70 Islamic militants attacked army vehicles with anti-aircraft missiles and that more than 20 people were killed. Prime Minister Ibrahim Mehlib declared that Egypt is now in a state of actual war. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Hundreds of pro-democracy activists took to the streets of Hong Kong on Wednesday. It comes as the city marks the 18th anniversary of its handover from British to Chinese rule. Thousands of police were on standby for the annual march, the first large-scale protest since police forcibly cleared pro-democracy demonstrators from the streets last year. The protest comes less than 2 weeks after pro-democracy legislators blocked a China-backed proposal that would have let a committee of elites screen candidates for the city's first leadership election. Indonesian authorities say the death toll from a military transport plane crash has spiked to 141, and rescuers continue searching the wreckage in a residential neighborhood on the island of Sumatra. The Hercules C-140 crashed into two houses and a hotel on Tuesday. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Islamic militants attacked Egyptian army and police positions in the northern Sinai Wednesday, causing numerous casualties. Egyptian media report that the Islamic State group has claimed responsibility.
That's Edward Uranian reporting from Cairo. We'll have full details coming up. Also, Royal Air Force flights left England today to repatriate the bodies of an estimated 27 Britons who died in a shooting spree at a Tunisian beach resort. The UNHCR reports 137,000 people crossed the Mediterranean Sea into Europe during the first 6 months of this year, the highest number on record. And health workers in Liberia are scrambling to contain the latest recurrence of the deadly Ebola virus. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Islamic militants attacked Egyptian army and police positions in the northern Sinai today, causing numerous casualties. Egyptian media report that the Islamic State group has claimed responsibility. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Amateur video showed an explosion followed by a gigantic fireball after militants attacked one of a number of army checkpoints near the North Sinai town of Sheikh Zawayid. Egyptian media report that dozens of soldiers were killed in a series of attacks on military positions in the northern Sinai. A military spokesman indicated that 70 Islamic militants attacked army vehicles with anti-aircraft missiles and that more than 20 people were killed. The militants reportedly took a number of soldiers prisoner. Prime Minister Ibrahim Mehlib declared that Egypt is now in a state of actual war. Israel reportedly closed a series of border crossings with Egypt, and state TV reported that the Egyptian military raised its state of alert to level C. Several media outlets reported that the militants had taken control of Sheikh Zawayid and surrounded the police compound. VOA could not independently confirm the report. Al Jazeera TV reported that the attack was the largest of its kind against the Egyptian military ever, and that Russian-made Hornet missiles were used in the strike. The TV's correspondent, who is in contact with Islamist activists, reported that hundreds of militants attacked a series of army targets. Apache helicopters and fighter jets launched counterstrikes against the militants amid reports that the attackers had mined several main highways and that ambulances were not able to evacuate some casualties. An army spokesman told journalists that the attacks were still taking place as of midday. Wednesday's attacks followed a series of car bomb blasts on Monday and Tuesday, one of which killed the country's top prosecutor, Hisham Barakat. Tuesday marked the second anniversary of the 2013 army ouster of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi. An Egyptian court recently confirmed death sentences against him and a number of top Muslim Brotherhood leaders. Analyst and retired Army General Ahmed Abdel Halim told Egyptian media that he thought the Muslim Brotherhood was involved in the recent attacks, along with outside supporters. Halim says that C4 plastic explosives were used in the recent attacks, which he says came from outside the country. He accuses the Muslim Brotherhood of funding terrorist activities inside the country with support from its allies. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi insisted Tuesday that the country would reinforce and execute its laws to make sure that justice is carried out quickly. It was not clear if he meant that death sentences against Muslim Brotherhood leaders would be carried out. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Air Force flights left England today for Tunisia. They will repatriate the bodies of an estimated 27 Britons who died in a shooting spree at a beach resort. Other victims of the June 26 massacre have been identified as Irish, Belgian, German, Russian, and Portuguese nationals. Meanwhile, a Tunisian government spokesman says the gunman who was shot at the scene was trained by jihadists in neighboring Libya. Tunisian police killed 24-year-old Saeed Regzi at the scene of the resort hotel shooting. Tunisian investigators say Regzi and several men tied to the March 18th killing more than a dozen tourists at a Tunis museum received training from jihadist militias in Libya at the same time. Britain has pledged a tough response after last Friday's terror attack in Tunisia that killed up to 30 British tourists. The attack came just days before the 10th anniversary of the bomb attacks on London's transport network. As Henry Ridgewell reports, security services are having to shift the focus of their counterterrorism operations overseas.
In eerily realistic scenes, three gunmen shoot their way into a London metro station. Outside, bodies lie in the street. Britain's emergency response is put to the test as police, fire and ambulance units rush to the scene. The two-day drill, taking place this week, is designed to mimic recent attacks in Paris and Sydney. For many Londoners, it's also a grim reminder of events 10 years ago. The July 7th bombings that targeted the city's transport network. Maxine De Brunner is Deputy Assistant Commissioner of London's Metropolitan Police Force.
Tragically, after 7/7, of course, we took the learning. We adapted our policies and our procedures. But styles of attack, they also change and we have to evolve and make sure that we're ready and we have the right skills to be able to respond.
Security services say the drill is not in response to Friday's attack in Sousse, Tunisia, that killed at least 38 people, the majority of them British. Survivors have been returning to emotional homecomings. Bodies are also being repatriated. British Prime Minister David Cameron vowed a tough response.
First, we must give our police and security services the tools they need to root out this poison. We must be stronger at standing up for our values, and we must be more intolerant of intolerance.
But the heart of counter-terrorism is shifting overseas, says Raffaello Pantucci of the Royal United Services Institute.
The ideology is such now that it basically says you attack Westerners wherever you can find them and whatever they look like. And so whatever target becomes possible becomes a potential target. The problem is that multiplies the sort of number of potential targets and in a huge number of potential countries.
Tunisia's president, Beji Caid Essebsi, admitted Tuesday that security services were taken by surprise.
Ils ont pris des dispositions pour le mois de Ramadan.
The president said the security forces made provisions for the month of Ramadan, but he said they never would have thought that it would happen on the beaches where the tourists are. David Cameron has not specified the policies that will form his response to the Tunisia attacks. It must involve working with overseas allies, says Pantucci.
It has to be about building local capacity, because that's the main lever that you have. All you can really do is help develop the locals so that they are able to respond to their domestic threat more effectively.
At home, lawmakers have pledged to tackle what they call poisonous ideology. Candidate for Mayor of London, Tessa Jowell, a minister at the time of the 7/7 attacks, said the city has become more united in the decades since.
Killers fantasise about religious wars, while Muslims across our city break their fast in London synagogues. They imagine a city divided while all faiths march together at London Pride.
Britain's security services say a domestic attack is highly likely. They are well drilled in their response. But the attack in Tunisia underlines the limits of their abilities to protect nationals overseas. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Coming up on 15 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A new report from the United Nations Refugee Agency shows that a record 137,000 migrants have made the journey across the Mediterranean Sea so far this year, an 83% increase compared to the same period last year. The UN High Commissioner on Refugees released a report today saying Europe is living through a maritime refugee crisis of historic proportions as those migrants make the risky journey to seek better living and economic conditions in Europe. The increase in numbers of migrants has placed a strain on Europe's resources, particularly those of Italy and Greece, a first stop for many migrants crossing the sea. Because of the increase, the report says more people are dying en route, many traveling in overcrowded, rickety boats across the sea from Turkey or North Africa. The UN says 1,867 migrants have been killed in this year's journeys. Migrant traffic is expected to stay high over the next few months as refugees and people smugglers take advantage of warm weather in the Mediterranean. The Italian Navy recovered the bodies of the first eight of an estimated 800 migrants who drowned when a smuggler's fishing trawler sank in the Mediterranean 3 months ago. Officials say a minesweeper and two other naval vessels are using remote-controlled submersible baskets to recover the drowning victims. Bodies have been found at a depth of 1,200 feet on the seafloor. Most are believed to be trapped within the hold of the sunken trawler. Italy's Red Cross is supervising refrigeration of the corpses for return to relatives. Migrant arrivals have almost doubled compared to last year. The UN Refugee Agency estimates more than 137 migrants have reached Europe so far. Since Italy received the first major flood of migrants, many are now arriving in other European countries. Hungary says it received about 67,000 migrants this year. They have joined Serbia and Austria in asking the EU help with the latest arrivals. Hungary announced construction of a 110-mile fence along their Serbian border to slow the migrant flow. Earlier this week, Hungarian police used tear gas to control rioting migrants in one camp. Lesotho is threatening to erupt into violence again less than a year after one of its former leaders fled into exile in South Africa. Now the brutal killing of a top military officer has sent former leaders back into South Africa, where they are watching anxiously as regional officials head into Lesotho to try to restore peace. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to one of the people who fled and reports from Johannesburg.
Lesotho has had a disproportionate share of troubles in the last year, from a reported coup attempt in August to a recent spate of violence and reports of a growing political crisis. The landlocked nation surrounded by South Africa has seen years of political feuding and tension between the police and army. The trigger for the most recent tension was the brutal slaying of the former army chief in front of his children last month. That, says opposition leader Tesele Maserebane, spurred him and two top leaders, including the former prime minister and a top female leader, to flee to South Africa. Maserebane, who heads the opposition Basotho National Party, spoke to VOA News from Johannesburg, where he says he plans to apply for political asylum. Maserebane says reliable sources told him that he was on the list of targets of controversial army commander Tlali Kumuri, who Maserebane says is the man who orchestrated the killing of former Lesotho Defense Force commander Maparankwe Mahau. The two men were bitter rivals.
Running away from Lieutenant General Kamodi orders that we must be arrested and be assassinated. We flee for lives. That's how simple I can put it.
South Africa has sent its deputy president into Lesotho in an attempt to reduce tensions. Regional leaders from the Southern African Development Community handled last year's crisis by bringing elections forward, a move that temporarily brought calm. But Maserebane says mediators have consistently failed to address a major issue in Lesotho. One of the issues is Kamuri himself, whose firing last August led to the attempted coup. He was then reinstated by the new leader, against mediators' recommendations.
The security issue has been an outstanding issue that was never addressed by the facilitator or by the SADC. The issue of the Lesotho Defense Force succession, the issue of the arrest of those special forces members that killed people the issues of the 29th of August are addressed.
The United States has urged Lesotho to investigate Mahau's death and to conduct urgent security sector reform. Masarabane says the Lesotho government also needs to clean up its own affairs.
I think the most important thing that has to be that we need a special independent investigation into the matters. We need arrest. We need to see arrest. We need to see justice being outlined in Lesotho. We need to see those people going behind us. We have killed people. Nobody can just go on shooting people on a day in front of his children. Nobody has the right to kill people. They're not refusing to go to justice because he's a soldier. This is something that the world has to support.
This is an issue that affects South Africa directly. As Lesotho's only neighbor, violence in the mountainous enclave could spill over into South Africa. Anita Pal, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A new UN Human Rights Commission report condemns extensive and far-reaching human rights abuses by Boko Haram insurgents in Nigeria and in three neighboring countries. UN Human Rights Chief Zayed Rahat Al Hussein says Nigerian survivors of several years of violence reported the abduction of female residents. They also reported the mass killings of men and boys who were gunned down or hacked to death by Boko Haram. Zayed says women and girls have been sexually enslaved, raped, and forced into so-called marriages. Many survivors of these horrific experiences are now pregnant by the rapists. It is vital that the authorities ensure that every person who has been responsible for such crimes will be held to account in a court of law. Meanwhile, Nigerian military authorities in Lagos have announced the arrest of a businessman they claim participated in the abduction of more than 270 schoolgirls from a boarding school in Chibok last year. Spokesman Major General Chris Alakulade identifies Babuji Yaari as an active participant in the kidnappings and in the 2014 assassination of the Emir of Gwoza. Alakulade says Yaari pretended to be a member of a youth vigilante group defending his community from Boko Haram attacks. French President François Hollande visits Cameroon on Friday, his first to the country. His trip coincides with growing anti-France sentiment over economic ties and controversy over why many of the weapons seized from the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram are of French origin. Moki Edwin Kinziga has more from Yaoundé.
Cameroonians sing along the streets of the political capital Yaoundé that they are disgruntled with the French government. Professor Yimgang Moyo-Tiofil, president of the Citizens Movement political party, says the protest ahead of French President François Hollande's visit is because the French government has maintained a strong grip on Cameroon's economy through colonial agreements that stop the Central African nation from seeking more profitable markets for its natural resources. He says 65% of Cameroon's financial reserves are kept in the French treasury following agreements signed in 1948 when Cameroon was still a French colony.
La France a toujours la mainmise sur la majorité.
He says bilateral agreements between France and Cameroon authorize mostly French enterprises to exploit most of Cameroon's forest and mining resources, even when Chinese companies propose more profitable deals. He says even the CFA franc currency used by Cameroon was pegged to the French franc in an agreement that should no longer exist, because France now uses the euro, yet France still controls Cameroon's currency. At the dawn of multi-party politics in Cameroon in 1990, Cameroon's main opposition party leader, John Frundi, called for a boycott of French goods and accused France of supporting Paul Biya to stay in power for his loyalty to the French. Professor Yimga Moyo says since then, France reviewed its visa policies towards Cameroon. He says last year, close to 800,000 Cameroonians applied for visas to study or do business in France, but that just 7,000 Cameroonian students study in France. Professor Sinjun Pokam of the University of Yaoundé says Cameroonians are also angry over France's domineering role in Cameroon politics.
C'est anti-français, hein, et État français, c'est pas le peuple de France, non.
He says many Cameroonians are developing hatred for the French government because since Cameroon's independence, France has always wanted to dominate Cameroon's politics by imposing people loyal to it at decision-making positions. In March this year, Chad's communication minister, Hassan Sila Ben Bakari, during a visit to Cameroon, said 40% of arms and other war material used by the terrorist group Boko Haram were of French origin. Sinjun Pokam says they expect France to explain to Cameroon, Chad, Nigeria and Niger how the weapons get to the terrorists.
Ça veut dire que de toute façon, c'est la France qui a fourni ces armes. Que ces armes.
He says people are convinced that France is responsible for terrorism in Nigeria and Cameroon because France has never issued a rebuttal. They do not supply arms to Boko Haram, even though a majority of the weapons seized are of French origin. French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius, in an interview with VOA, said he had been informed of the growing anti-French sentiment in Cameroon, but strongly denied his country supports Boko Haram, as Cameroonians claim.
I have been very surprised, when I was discussing with Madame Ambassador, when she told me that here, some people were saying or thinking that France was not against Boko Haram. It's a figment, but a horrible figment of their imagination. If one nation, one great nation throughout the world is fighting Boko Haram, it's France. And there is no doubt about it.
Cameroon's Minister of Communication, Issa Chiruma Bakari, says he blames especially the French media for giving an impression relations between Cameroon and France are tensed.
Vous avez des journalistes qui critiquent le gouvernement français. Non, RFI et France 24.
He says there are many journalists, some working with RFI and France 24, criticizing relations between France and Cameroon, but that he wants to categorically state that such journalists do not speak for the French government. François Hollande, who will be visiting Cameroon for the first time as president, will spend barely 4 hours in the Central African nation. Authorities in Cameroon say he will discuss the war against Boko Haram and social and economic ties with President Paul Biya. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's coming up on 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
socialize. Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Islamic militants attack Egyptian army and police positions in the northern Sinai, causing numerous casualties. Royal Air Force flights left England today to repatriate the bodies of an estimated 27 Britons who died in a shooting spree at a Tunisian beach resort. And health workers in Liberia are scrambling to contain the latest recurrence of the deadly Ebola virus. Coming up, we'll have music from Uganda and our feature segment. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand Women's World Cup tops your sports report today.
Kim, we're going to kick off with Women's World Cup football. The United States will play either surprise package England or reigning world champion Japan in Sunday's final in Vancouver, Canada. In the semifinals, the American women beat top-ranked Germany 2-0 at the Olympic Stadium in Montreal before a pro-USA crowd of more than 51,000. U.S. team captain Carly Lloyd was the player of the match. She scored the first goal off a penalty kick in the 69th minute and then set up teammate Kelly O'Hara for the second goal in the 84th minute. Talk to us about your big game, Carly.
Well, I've just been training my butt off for the last 12 years. You know, these are the moments that I live for. This is kind of when I roll my sleeves up and say to myself, I have to step up. And I think that, you know, with Jill and the coaching staff kind of giving me the flexibility to express myself out on the field, you know, I just need to deliver and in any way possible. You know, tonight was stepping up for the PK. But I'd say, you know, mentally as well, you know, I've just kind of been trained to become a fierce competitor, live for challenges and never quit, no matter what the scenario is.
The scenario in the 59th minute in Montreal was Germany had a chance to take a 1-0 lead. USA defender Julie Johnston misplayed a ball into the box and yanked down Germany's Alexandra Popp by the shoulder. Some observers thought Johnston should have been shown a red card, but she was given a yellow, and up stepped Celia Sasic, the World Cup's leading scorer with 6 goals, to take the penalty kick. She knocked it wide of the left post, though, and about 8 minutes later, the USA took the lead on Carly Lloyd's penalty kick. That also proved controversial. Video replay showed the foul by Germany's Annika Kron on the USA's Alex Morgan occurred outside the penalty area. But as I told Douglas the Mighty Ampuga before the show this evening, that's football. Final score from Montreal, USA 2, Germany 0. It sets up a possible rematch of the 2011 Women's World Cup final should Japan beat England later Wednesday evening in Edmonton, Canada. Japan beat the United States on penalty kicks 4 years ago in the Women's World Cup final in Germany. That was Japan's first World Cup title. The American women are bidding for an unprecedented third World Cup crown after lifting the trophy in 1991 and 1999.
This is the Voice of America. Washington, Bamboozit, D.C.
This is Larry Zamude, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA. VOA! And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9 Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to sports radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Superstar Lionel Messi has led Argentina into Saturday's final in the Copa America football tournament in Chile. The midfield magician Messi helped set up 5 goals as Argentina trounced Paraguay 6-1 in the semifinals. Argentina will play host Chile for the trophy on Saturday. Messi assisted on first half goals by Marcos Rojo and Javier Pastore and one of Angel Di Maria's second half goals. The Barcelona star also helped set up Argentina's final 2 goals by Sergio Aguero and Gonzalo Higuain. Striker Lucas Barrios scored the only goal for Paraguay, which was trying to reach its second straight Copa America final after losing to Uruguay in the 2011 tournament. In Saturday's final, Argentina will try to end a 22-year title drought and give Messi his first big triumph with the national team. Chile, meanwhile, will be going for its first South American crown. VOA's Jonah Haskell joins us now with a Wednesday Wimbledon tennis update. Sporty greetings, Jonah.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Tennis fans were treated to the opening serves of the second round of Wimbledon early on Wednesday, with several stars seeing action. Russian star Maria Sharapova breezed through her second round match with Rachel Hogenkamp of the Netherlands, losing only 4 games en route to a straight sets victory, while unseeded American Coco Vandeweghe pulled off one of the biggest upsets of the tournament so far, defeating 11th seed Karolina Pliskova 7-6, 6-4. On the men's side of things, Novak Djokovic, the 2014 Wimbledon champion and the current world number one, faced the aging Finnish player Jarkko Nieminen. Nieminen recently announced his plans to retire at the end of the season. He was unable to keep up with Djokovic's powerful forehand as the Joker won the match in straight sets 6-4, 6-2, 6-3. One of Novak's old rivals, Rafael Nadal, is set to play his second round match against Dustin Brown of Germany sometime in the next couple of days. Nadal lost to Djokovic in the 2011 Wimbledon final. He's recently seen his career derailed by injuries, but after an easy win in the first round, Rafa says he's feeling confident about his chances this year.
You know, I'm a little bit more confident now that was a few months ago, but just day by day for me, you know, and obviously victories helps, and last 2 months, let's say, I am playing much more solid almost every tournament.
Will this be the tournament that Nadal gets back on track and wins his 15th major title? No one can say yet, although Wimbledon title ambitions are already over for one major contender. Japan's Kei Nishikori, seeded 5th this year, has withdrawn from the tournament due to a calf injury. His intended second-round opponent, Santiago Giraldo, was awarded a walkover to the 3rd round. And that's our Wednesday Wimbledon tennis update. Back to you, Sonny.
Thanks, Jonah. South Africa has named a 49-man preliminary squad for 2 big upcoming rugby tournaments. VOA's Tadi Abeje tells us more.
The Springboks of South Africa will compete in the Four Nation Rugby Championship in July and August, and the 2010 Rugby World Cup in September and October. Of the 49 players head coach Heineke Meyer selected, more than a dozen are currently injured, including team captain Jean de Villiers.
That moment, you know, I've replayed it so many times in my head, and you play it back in slow-mo, and you know, I can just remember that feeling of, oh dear, here we go, you know, and then it happened. The force was basically just too big, you know, for me to fight it, and, you know, the rest is history.
That's South African rugby captain Jean de Villiers. Coach Meyer says he'll use the matches against Australia, New Zealand and Argentina in the Rugby Championship as a warm-up for the Rugby World Cup.
The tough thing now is that, you never want to do it, but you probably have to use a championship as preparation for the World Cup as well. And we've planned well, and I'm very positive, and let's just get through the 2-3 first games, and I truly believe we'll be fine for the World Cup.
The Springboks will be playing in their 6th Rugby World Cup. They lifted the trophy in 1995 and 2007. The tournament will take place from September 18th to October 31st in England. For the Sunny Side of Sports, I'm VOA's Tati Abeje.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Follow the sunny side of sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a nice photo of USA captain Carly Lloyd, who we heard from earlier in the show, being hugged by her teammates after converting a penalty kick against Germany in the semifinals of the Women's World Cup football tournament. It was Lloyd's third goal in three knockout round matches for the USA at this World Cup. Commenting on the Facebook photo, Ibe Okwudiri, writing from Lagos, Nigeria, said, "That's the spirit of champions." And speaking of champions, let's give a sunny side of sports shout out for 40-year-old American defender Christy Rampone, the oldest player to appear in a Women's World Cup. In fact, Christy is playing in her fifth, count them, five Women's World Cups. She's the only member of the current USA team to be on that trophy-winning World Cup squad from 1999. As we look ahead to Saturday's big final in Vancouver, let's bring back Jonah and Toddy. Jonah, who do you like? Can the USA win a third World Cup title?
I definitely say at this point it's looking pretty good for the United States. Whoever they end up facing in the final, whether it's Japan or England, just is neither of them are as good teams as the U.S. is.
And who do you like on Sunday, Toddy?
The U.S. will defeat, get revenge on Japan, because the U.S. Right now is the best team in the World Cup, because they have the best defense in the World Cup and the best goalie in the World Cup.
And in fact, when I listened to the show on Tuesday, I think you said the X factor could be Carly Lloyd.
Yes, I did say that, as she was the one that knocked in the goal in yesterday's game against
Germany. And she set up the second goal, too.
She did set up the second goal.
So we'll see now whether the USA plays England or defending champion Japan on Saturday. Excuse me, on Sunday in Vancouver, Canada. That will be the seventh Women's World Cup final. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, thanking Jonah Haskell and Tati Abeje, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and also thank you, Jonah and Tati. Listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, the mobile car for hire service known around the world as Uber is generating buzz in Kenya. And Kenya's government lifts a 2.5-month suspension on 13 remittance companies. First, here's Stella Nantezia of Uganda with Majangwa.
Yesu
utwawe wa
kero munonye
kabarije
amatika mwe kusanze
gakachwana nyo
majangwa
shalawa.
We'll be right back.
kugamba
byamuwe na nyo
we mwache Yesu
utwawe wa
kero mononye
yabarije
amatika mwe kusanze
gata chwana nyo
majangwa
shaoma leo
ukedote mia kujukira bien kugamba kujukira bwa jema Katonda wo sogo ni jama jangwa Woli sanga wachitange We, watuazirunda Majangwa
Sala wolu wa lero
Ibi gambo bien kugamba
Yamu wendo nyo
We, wate Yesu
Wetuwa wewa
Kero mononye
Lavalize
Amatika mwe kusanze
Kakachwano nyo
Majangwa
Sala wolu wa lero
Ukedoru mwa Mboko sabaru wabu jemu Zeku sabirogu chawe Nesi ujiwumule Chiwe wayo majangwa Weno sembe sa sitani Tabu yambe Tosa zonkubi Ojele kakwenda senda Kukumira ni muhanji Usanze yojoita Yero nijene wa Yesu Ulebu sanobu jemu We chewa kuyamba Majangwa
Sala wolu wa lero
Ibi gambo bien kugamba
Yabu wenu nyo
Mwate Yesu
Mwate wewa
Kero mononye
Nabarije
Amatika mwe kusanze
Kakachwana nyo
Majangwa
Shalawolu wa lero
Teza of Uganda with Majangwa. Well, the mobile car for hire service known around the world as Uber has finally arrived in Kenya and is generating some buzz. But as Hillary Hewler reports from Nairobi, local Kenyan competition is stiff and not everyone thinks Uber knows what it's getting itself into.
When Franklin Sayalel first heard a new taxi company was setting up shop in Nairobi, where he runs a fashion business, he was more confused than excited.
At first, I didn't get it. I mean, I checked it out and it was like all these fancy cars. So I didn't get the concept. Was it like a company that has cars? Then later on, I found out like there are people who actually like rent out their cars. I didn't get the whole concept.
The company was Uber, which launched in Nairobi in January. This isn't Uber's first foray into sub-Saharan Africa. It also operates in South Africa and Nigeria. But when the company landed in Kenya, it found it wasn't alone. There are at least three other mobile taxi hailing services in Nairobi, at least two of which maintain they're better suited to the local market. Marimoja uses social media to find taxi drivers your friends trust, claiming that personal recommendations carry the most weight with Kenyans. MyTaxi appeals to price-sensitive customers by having drivers bid for each ride. Some say a business dependent on GPS maps is problematic in a country where people usually navigate by landmarks, and complain that Uber drivers tend to get lost. Sayalel says he's had this problem with Easy Taxi, another Uber-like service from Brazil.
Most of them don't even know how to read the GPS. So you're actually waiting for your cab and you're seeing on the, you know, on the app, the guy's just driving around in circles. He's not getting the location. And I've had experiences where I just canceled my trip.
But the biggest hurdle Uber has faced is probably payments. Until last week, the service only accepted credit or debit cards, despite the fact that only a small percentage of Kenyans use them, an estimated 4% in 2012, only a little higher now. Uber now accepts cash and mobile money payments. But Mwambu Wanendea of Uber Africa says they're still fighting the perception that Uber is an upscale product.
I don't think that people realize that the prices are in fact very, very competitive, and in many cases cheaper than the regular taxis. I think that's because people who use them have a smartphone. There's a perception that the rides are more expensive than they actually are.
Wanendea says his company's Nairobi customer base has been growing fast. But Mark Manyuru, one of the founders of MyTaxi, says that Uber still has a long way to go before it's embraced by the masses. His cost-cutting service, he says, is aimed at ordinary Kenyans.
We have Uber for people jetting in at JKIA. We have Uber for tourists. They love Uber. What happens to the common Kenyan? So the need is what we are trying to solve.
Kenya certainly isn't Uber's only competitive market. Its pockets are deep, and it's used to fighting for users. But Manyuru says he's not intimidated.
This particular market is different from the others Uber has taken over. Let's take a look at Singapore, for example. It has got structures. It has got a pre-existing taxi culture. The amount of convincing Uber has to do within this particular market basically makes them a startup too. There's no difference between us and them.
It can be hard for foreign companies to figure out what Kenyans want, notes Sayalel. It is possible to introduce such fancy ideas here, he says, but don't expect it to be easy. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Kenyan government has lifted a 2.5-month suspension on 13 remittance companies. The licenses were revoked and their accounts frozen in April following the deadly attack by Al-Shabaab militants on Garissa University, where 148 people were killed by Al-Shabaab militants from Somalia. Abdirashid Duale is chief executive officer of Dahabshil, the largest money transfer company in Somalia. Duale tells reporter Haroon Maruf he is eager to get back into business.
We are very happy that the Kenyan government has lifted the suspension on Dahabshil with immediate effect. We have already started our operation here in Kenya so that we can serve the Kenyan, the Somalis, international communities that use Dahabshil.
And how did this come about? What happened after 2 months?
We have been engaging with the Kenyan officials to explain that our policy, our procedures, so that they can understand what the work we do. We operate, Dahabshil has operations over 120 countries all over the world, including the United States, Europe, UK, and we have a presence in 40 African countries. So it was only Kenya that were our license was suspended in April. So we explained to them that, you know, the work we do, our policy and procedures, and they have allowed us to resume our operation, which we are very happy.
And what explanation did they give you for the reason they suspended the license in the first place?
You know, the central bank and the Kenyan government have obviously made their own decision in April to suspend all licensed remittance companies. It's not only the Dahabshil, they have suspended all entire remittance companies. And now, obviously, they made their own decision again. Clearly, they review our policy, our procedures, our system, the work we do, who used to have share, and so on. And we're very happy that, you know, they are comfortable with us and they have lifted the suspension. The Habshield serve a lot of communities. And all over the world, we offer a lifeline service to millions of people who depend on our services. And we create jobs here. You know, we play an important part in terms of development and, you know, investment opportunity. And we compete with the global companies. So companies like the Habshield provide efficient service to many who rely on the Habshield. And we're very happy that the Kenyan government allowed us to resume our operation.
Abdelrasheed Diwali is Chief Executive Officer of the Habshield, the largest money transfer company in Somalia. He was speaking with reporter Haroon Maruf. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the U.S. State Department prepares detailed reports assessing respect for human rights around the world. The reports, required by law, evaluate how the governments of every country and a number of territories demonstrate respect for human dignity and individual freedoms. Lawmakers, as well as authorities in the executive branch, use the reports to help shape our nation's foreign policies. They also signal to the human rights defenders and activists under siege that our government recognizes their struggle and stands with civil society in its efforts to preserve human rights. For far too many people, 2014 was defined by suffering and abuse perpetrated by terrorist groups exploiting religious discourse and divisions to advance their totalitarian ideology, and by governments like Syria acting repressively in the name of combating terrorism. Meanwhile, governments in China, Egypt, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Iran, Russia, and Saudi Arabia, among others, continue to stifle free and open media and the development of civil society through the imprisonment of journalists, bloggers, and nonviolent critics. As in previous years, human rights conditions in Zimbabwe are a particular concern. The most important human rights problems remain the government's targeting for torture, abuse, arrest, and harassment of members of non-ZANU-PF parties and civil society activists. There also continues to be a partisan application of the rule of law by security forces and the judiciary, as well as restrictions on civil liberties. The government took limited steps to punish security sector officials and ZANU-PF supporters who committed violations, but impunity continued to be a problem. The United States has seen its own share of racial discord and unrest in the last year. We approach this report with great self-awareness, but we also understand that when human rights is the issue, every country, including our own, has room to improve. We are committed to the work of advancing universal rights, building the partnerships that will move us forward, helping every man, woman, and child live up to their potential. In cases of nations such as Zimbabwe, we are also committed to speaking out for those unable to do so for themselves.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events. as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.